Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. I'm talking today with Stephen Deusner, author of the book Where the Devil Don't Stay, Traveling the South with the Drive-By Truckers. Stephen, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I've been a fan of Drive-By Truckers for maybe about 10 years now. I've spent a lot of time listening to them. I've seen them live several times. I never am quite clear on what that weird name means. Do you have any insight into why that's the name of this band, Drive-By Truckers? It sort of makes them a little bit unrecommendable, you know?
It is hard. When I've told people who don't know about the band I'm working on, it's always a little bit like, oh, but, you know, it's the Drive-By Truckers, but they're really good. Like, you know,
right.
They'll be the first to admit it's not a very good name. In fact, I think Patterson, who's one of the frontmen, has written an article for NPR about how bad that name is. But I think it comes from a time when, you know, in the 90s, when you had a lot of alt country bands coming up and there was a sort of sense of humor that was driven by sort of puns and wordplay and that kind of like ironic country kitsch. And so I think that's partly where it comes from. But on a more serious note, and one that I think definitely redeems the name and speaks to where they're coming from and what they want to do musically, you know, you've got two parts of it. You've got Trucker, which kind of speaks to this kind of country, everyman, working class kind of ethos, which is certainly what they do. But then you've got Drive-By, which speaks to a very different experience, a Black experience. One that was taken up by a lot of hip hop bands that they were a fan of. Patterson in particular has talked about how influential a lot of hip hop, especially Southern hip hop, was for him as a songwriter. And so I think that was a way of pointing to that influence in a way that I think a lot of fans of Southern rock might not pick up on or might not think about. And I think they wanted to sort of foreground that there was that aspect of what they were doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think of Drive-By Truckers as being one of several bands that are not musically at all hip hop, but that have lyrically are very much influenced by that kind of storytelling style that you hear in hip hop. Like I know John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats is a big hip hop fan. Craig Finn from the Hold Steady is a big hip hop fan. And I feel like I never thought of Drive-By Truckers as being in that category until I read your book.
Oh, well, yeah, no, they and I think what unites those three bands is this really strong emphasis on character and story and especially setting. And I think you could probably draw lines from each of those bands and those elements to hip hop.
Mm-hmm. You start the book with a description of a Patterson Hood solo show where he plays the song What It Means, which is kind of his response to the Black Lives Matter movement. Why did you decide to open the book that way?
You know, it's funny. I shuffled the chapters around a lot. I tried different orders. I tried different things, but that opening remained constant throughout the entire book. And partly that is something that's very personal to me, which was I had been living in England, the first half of 2016, which is where I started writing this book. And I came back, and that was the first live show I saw was at Saturn there. And I think kind of being sort of just like dropped in very abruptly from like Birmingham, England to Birmingham, Alabama, it left a huge impression. And, you know, in England, they had just voted for Brexit, which I think like the morning it was announced, people were like, this is a bad idea. It was like a slow motion kind of no, you know, from a movie or something like that. It just felt like something was happening. Something like this bad wave was starting. And I think that totally came through in that year's election and some things that have happened since then. And I remember that performance of that song standing out because it just felt like it was coming from the center of the storm. And it was this guy who was trying hard to sort of make sense of something, but was not wanting to put too fine a point on it, was not really wanting to speak for people he couldn't speak for. He was not trying to come up with pat answers. I mean, the song is called What It Means, and it's just a guy kind of asking questions and trying to figure out what this says about, like, all these events say, you know, all this violence says about his country. And I thought, you know, in that moment, I found something that to me spoke to what this band had accomplished over 20 years and why they were so important to me and to so many other people, not just Southerners, but people from all over the world. And it kind of showed how the band had helped people make sense of where they came from, how to sort of reconcile a love of home with some of the uglier aspects of that place or some of the uglier history of that place.
One of the kind of arcs that I see in the course of Drive-By Truckers' career is going from being a band that's really concerned about Southern history to being a band that kind of understands that the core questions of Southern history are also the core questions of American history. You know, how do we move forward with any sense of pride when our history is a history of genocide and slavery? That's not a question that is only relevant in Alabama. How do you feel like they made that journey? What were kind of the steps that made them go from being a band that has an album called Southern Rock Opera to being a band that has an album called American Band?
Yeah, it's such an interesting trajectory too. They call that the duality of the Southern thing in the Southern Rock Opera. And that's like a well-quoted lyric. And one that I think is so open to a lot of interpretation. And that is what I have always interpreted to mean, is that it is about being both proud of where you come from and disgusted by it. And I think that mix creates a kind of activism that makes you want to try and change that place. And so I think that trajectory kind of starts where they're just a band who just wants to have something. They just want to play for audiences, and they want to sort of represent where they came from. I mean, Patterson and Mike Cooley, who's the other frontman, is they both hail from North Alabama in the Muscle Shoals region, and they kind of grew up and came of music age at a time when that area was not putting out as much great music as it had in the past. And they sort of wanted to put that on the place back on the map. And they did that by writing about that place, often not in glowing terms, as on the song Buttholeville. I think that stuck with them throughout everything they did, was just like they wanted to put this place back on the map, whether that place was, you know, the Shoals or Athens, where they kind of got their start, or just the South in general. And I think that they were so aware of where they came from, and they were so aware of how that place was misrepresented in pop culture. And they kind of came at that with this kind of irreverent attitude that, you know, really fed the first decade of albums and, or decade, 15 years of albums. I mean, like all the way up to American Band. And I remember Patterson telling me when I interviewed him for American Band before the book started that, he kind of had this feeling like maybe they had run their course, like the albums weren't getting as much attention as they had in the past and they weren't getting reviewed as much, that sort of thing. And then American Band comes along and it's a very different album for them. They're addressing a lot of the same issues that they've always addressed, just not through the prism of character and setting. Mm-hmm. And I think that that to me is that's the turning point. I mean, it not only rejuvenated their career, but it kind of threw everything that had come before into this sharp relief and kind of created that trajectory that you were talking about just a minute ago of like, of this is a band that's it almost made so much sense. You thought they had been like had mapped this out beforehand, that this was always going to be their destination. It just seems so perfect. And so I think that that was kind of the culmination of that. And they've continued it since then on the three albums since then. But that was really the pivotal album. And it's amazing, too, that you just don't get a whole lot of bands who make such a pivotal album so late in their career. You know, you do have some like Dylan and the Stones and people like that. But, you know, it's very rare thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that album's a real highlight in their collection for sure. Do you think there's a way in which, I mean, you mentioned Athens being a big important band for them, and they still do a festival or a, you know, a residency in Athens. I don't know if they've been doing it during the pandemic, but regularly they do, like the Heathens. I don't know. Do you say, is it a festival, would you say, or?
Oh gosh, it's
convening, whatever you want to call it. Do you feel like there's a sense in which it was maybe necessary to have the sort of Athens scene of the 80s and 90s to kind of clear the ground away for a band like Drive-By Truckers to come around, like people like the B-52s, REM, Pylon, who are coming out of Athens, Georgia, but were really not, maybe with the exception of REM, really not interested in the kind of heritage of Southern rock, to kind of say, we're different, we're our own thing, we're a break from the past. Was that a kind of necessary step for then a band to be like, listen, we're not, you know, redneck racists, but we do think Freebird kind of rips, you know? Was that kind of, do you think that was kind of a necessary dialectic?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the history of Athens, is people saying, yeah, but it could also sound like this, or it could also sound like this. It doesn't have to be all Macon, Georgia. It doesn't have to be the Allman Brothers. And I think the Drive-By Truckers came along and said, it can be both. It can be everything. It's like, you know, it's a lot of different things happening all at once in regards to Athens. But yeah, and you know, that place is such a interesting incubator for a band like this, because you've got someone like Vic Chestnut, who's actually younger than Patterson by just a couple of months, but had already found his voice as a songwriter and as mm-hmm. a singer that was hugely influential to Patterson.
And he's Southern. I mean, his songwriting voice is super steeped in Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner and even Alan Tate and people like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Unmistakably, you cannot hear him and think this guy comes from South Dakota. Like, you could, I feel like I, the first time I heard it, I could pinpoint on a map in Georgia where it came from. And, you know, and I think that maybe for Patterson especially opened up an idea that, oh, I can just sound Southern. I don't have to disguise this. I can just be this Southern in the song and stuff like that. And at the same time, you're also getting a lot of these Elephant Six bands coming to town, which is musically totally different. But there's this philosophy that bands can just be these like mercurial, ever-changing, ever-mutating things. And I think that by adopting that, the Drive-By Truckers allowed themselves to be like, okay, if we're two guys show up tonight, we're just going to play as the drive-by truckers as two guys. If eight guys show up, we're going to still play as the drive-by truckers. And they could go on tour in whatever configuration, and it didn't matter if somebody left, and it could just kind of be this rolling, ongoing thing. And I think through a lot of hardship, especially early on, I think that kind of kept them afloat and kept this project going. It didn't have to be the set quartet like REM. It could be anything. It could be this kind of free floating thing. And I'll also add, I literally just got back from Heathen's Homecoming a couple of weeks ago. I don't know what you call it, but they do still have it. And it is still a really intense and amazing weekend. They did four nights this year, different set lists, different openers every night. It's one of the most amazing like rock shows I've ever seen.
I'll have to get down there one of these years.
Oh, it's amazing.
We talked a bit about Patterson. He I definitely get the sense in your book that he was the more loquacious of the two main members of the Drive-By Truckers. But I've always felt like Mike Cooley was in some ways an underrated component of the band, maybe because he talks less in interviews. Do you think it's fair to say that Patterson's sort of the rocker of the band and Cooley's the like Townes Van Zandt style country singer?
I think that's pretty fair. Although I think Cooley does rock out on a lot of these songs. But yeah, he's definitely steeped in country music, and he writes those country songs so well. And I was thinking just singing "Love Like This," which is this really twisted country song about like a pretty destructive relationship, and yet he just sings it in such a way that makes it sound very real and entertaining but he's definitely the more country of the two.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite Cooley songs is Carl Perkins' Cadillac, which you kind of depict as like a credo for the band. What do you feel like that song suggests about Drive-By Truckers' approach to kind of the rock and roll canon, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, it's funny. I've been thinking about that song in relationship to a new song he's just released called Every Single Storied Flame Out, which is off their upcoming album. It's not explicitly connected, but it has that same sort of kill your idols kind of approach. And, you know, Carl Perkins' Cadillac is sort of about this story about Sun Records that Sam Phillips would, you know, whoever had the first number one hit, I think it was, or maybe the first gold record, something like that, he would buy them a Cadillac. And of course, that Cadillac came out of their earnings. So it's like
they would buy themselves a Cadillac.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it was sort of like, you know, he made them, and he's also like, I don't know, he kind of exploited them a little bit as well. And so, excuse me, I feel like that song is about why you do what you do, like why you commit yourself to this rock and roll dream, to this music, to this lifestyle that doesn't always offer much reward. And, you know, what does your definition of success look like? Excuse me.
I can cut out the coughing in post-production, so don't worry.
Thank you.
I'm just noting down when it happens, so I'll be able to go back and edit it out. Sorry to hear that you're sick. I mean, it seems like there's some kind of cold going around.
It's allergies.
Oh, it's just allergies.
It hit my wife like a train. She had it worse than I did, but it's just been, awful. So we were talking about Carl Perkins' Cadillac.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I think that song is about why you do what you do, why you commit yourself to rock and roll when the rewards aren't always very rewarding. Like, And what does success even look like to you? Does it look like a Cadillac? Does it look like a Grammy? You know, there's that line about Jerry Lee driving his Cadillac to Nashville where they promise him a Grammy, and he turns the Cadillac around because he doesn't need a paperweight. Mm-hmm. And so like, what of those, like what makes this meaningful to you? And I think that's such an interesting question to pose in a song about Elvis and about Johnny Cash and about these guys who achieve great success, but also at these, you know, with great consequence to that success as well. And I always think about songs like that by the Truckers, but also by other bands, you know, you're going to have to live with that song on stage, at least for the next year. They're going to have to live with these songs night after night. And I always feel like, consciously or not, you know, that's a way of keeping yourself honest when you're out there on tour. That's a way of reminding yourself why you do something and why you do it the way that you do it. And I think there are other songs like that that you could point out to in some of these albums that are, you know, that are sort of messages to themselves, like Hell No, I Ain't Happy, mm-hmm. or something like that, that they're writing with the idea that they're going to have to live with these songs. And so they're trying to ground these messages in these songs and sort of keep themselves honest.
Yeah. Speaking of kind of classic great acts of rock and roll, their album Southern Rock Opera is a sort of complicated, multi-stranded narrative about Alabama in the 60s and 70s. And one of the main strands is the band Lynyrd Skynyrd. I've been listening to the Drive-By Truckers, like I said, for a while. I still don't know the answer to this question. Do they like Lynyrd Skynyrd?
I think I loved Cooley's description. He's like, I think of Lynyrd Skynyrd like I think of Jesus. A lot of the work is great, but I hate the fans.
Sure.
I think they have a genuine love for that band, especially that band that was active in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, and they were, when I interviewed them, they were talking about specific songs. They obviously knew this music very well. I don't think it was somebody who was just like, kind of came into this, did some research and wrote about Lynyrd Skynyrd. They had lived with this music for a long time. They also thought about it. Yeah.
They also mentioned in that album that they were sort of, when they were teenagers in the 70s, kind of, at least Patterson was kind of rebelling against that music. And it was the music that the jocks would play in the parking lot before football games. And he would be listening to, I don't know what he'd be listening to, but not Skynyrd, right?
Yeah, he had very eclectic taste even then, because, you know, his dad is David Hood. So he was exposed to a lot of different music. And it's funny that while Patterson is exploring, Cooley's just listening to the radio and whatever comes on the radio. And he liked Skynyrd, but he hated Freebird until he finally decided to listen to the entire song. And when it, you know, shifts gears towards the end, he was like, yes, this is amazing. But yeah. And it's weird too, because like, I think my experience was more like Patterson's, where for the longest time I was just like, Skynyrd is just awful. And there's sort of the music of my bullies growing up. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, before this, I'd kind of given him another chance and I liked it well enough. But one of the great surprises of writing this book was falling in love with a lot of their songs and realizing just how complex Lynyrd Skynyrd is. Like, it's almost like they represent a time that is so disconnected from how we think about things now that it's almost hard to even reconcile the actual band with the reputation they've developed over time.
And with the reputation the surviving members have curated, right? Like, they've purposely aligned themselves with right-wing politics in their kind of reincarnated status, right?
Oh, yeah. I kind of refer to them as like a zombie band, because like 10 years after that plane crash, they kind of rose from the dead, did this reunion show that was so massively popular that they just kept going and kept going with it. But without Ronnie Van Zant, you didn't have that nuance, that complicated quality, that contradiction. And I think it was just kind of like, yeah, like it was kind of wave the Confederate flag music, and it was very right wing, very reactionary music. And yeah, I think part of what's at the heart of Southern Rock Opera is trying to reconcile those two things. Like this band that was so amazing and so sort of set this idea, this complicated idea of what Southern rock could be, and it's like this kind of gross thing that it became.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting nuances about Skinner that Patterson points out in the song Ronnie and Neil is that even though there's that line in Sweet Home Alabama where he says, make sure Neil Young can remember a Southern man, don't need him around anymore, Ronnie and I guess the other members of Skinner too were big Neil Young fans. Why is that something that, I mean, that's like a relatively small, you know, detail of kind of musical arcana that Patterson feels the need to kind of put on the record, and kind of say, no, they didn't hate Neil Young. It's not their fault that he gets death threats when he tours in the South. What do you feel like, what's that supposed to say about the relationship between Skinner and kind of the history of racism in the South?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that they're playing with are these kind of like, an urban legend is not the right word, but
rural legend, you know, maybe.
Myths, yeah, yeah, like these myths that rise up around, among other things, rock stars. And there's the myth that Ronnie Van Zant was buried in his Neil Young T-shirt, which is not true, but it's an interesting legend. It's an interesting bit of lore that, like, why would you tell that? Like, why would that become a thing to tell people? Mm-hmm. And so I think, especially with Southern Man and then Sweet Home Alabama kind of sparring against each other, you know, it became too easy to take sides in that particular fight. And so I always thought that was an interesting bit of rock and roll history to put into a song, to clarify that, you know, it's not just these two sides butting heads against each other, but these two people who were intertwined and had a lot of mutual respect and admiration for each other, and that maybe didn't always come through in the music. Mm-hmm. But behind the music, there was something larger and more complicated going on. I always liked that little bit, because that was the first time I knew about that kind of fight between them, but I did not know that there was, you know, something else behind it. I did not know that Neil Young wrote a song for Lynyrd Skynyrd that they never got to record. Mm-hmm. So it just seemed like an interesting way to dispel certain myths about the South.
I that song always, that line in Sweet Home Alabama always like bothered me at like summer camp dances and stuff when they would play it when I was a kid. I'd be like, no, I'm on Team Neil, but maybe it's more complicated.
Well, I have always hated the song Southern Man. It's partly it's the sentiment, you know, because it feels like it's attacking me, but also mm-hmm. it just feels like it's a straw man kind of song.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's not even his best song about Alabama.
You know? Exactly. For a song to be remembered so well, it's like not even in his top, I don't know, 1,000. You know?
I think he's probably about up there now.
Yeah, yeah. So I never did like that song. So I was always Team Skynyrd, but I also heard Sweet Home Alabama, like, it seemed like every time I turned on the radio, mm-hmm. and I grew to hate that song. So... just through repetition, but that's also not one of their best songs either. So it's mm-hmm. it's it's odd that these two people are represented by maybe not their best, their best output.
Yeah. And I and it's not just a Southern thing too. I mean, Lynyrd Skynyrd is beloved throughout the country. I remember driving through rural Maine at night and the DJ played played Freebird. And it's a very long song. And after it, he goes, "That was, of course, Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd. And up next, we have the live version of Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd." So I was listening to Freebird for like a half an hour. Oh, and, wow. You know, it's, there's something to it. It's not, you know, it's very cliche, but, you know, hits become hits for a reason. It's not a bad song.
No. And there's a British TV show called The Old Grey Whistle Test. That from the 70s, and they played that, and man, they played Freebird on that and they tore it up. I mean, it's one of the best televised live performances I've seen. And they, and apparently the British director just let the camera on them. I mean, it's a long song and they didn't pause for commercial. They just let them jam for almost 20 minutes. It was wow. It's pretty, if you can go look that up, it's really remarkable.
Yeah. It's part of the reason that they were drawn to Skynyrd, that they kind of saw them as like kindred spirits in the way that like Skynyrd had been a working band, a kind of working class band who had just practiced all the time because they didn't want to work some shitty factory job and, you know, eventually found some success. Was that kind of like a potential career path for the Truckers? I mean, by the time Southern Rock Opera came out, Patterson and Cooley had been playing together for something like 15 years. Did they kind of see some of their work ethic reflected in Skynyrd?
Oh, most definitely. I, you know, Skynyrd had the Hell House, they called it. It was their practice space. It was like a shed out in the swamp, and it would get so hot that they would basically strip down and just jam. And for hours and hours and hours, I mean, they practiced every day despite those horrible conditions, and they got super tight. And I think the Truckers, despite the fact that they never rehearsed and made a point to never rehearse, really saw something in that work ethic that was inspiring to them. And I think they applied that to other aspects of band life, like touring. They were hard, mm-hmm. hard tourers early in their career. And so I definitely think that there was something about that work ethic that they identified with, as well as the fact that, you know, this was a band that they really, there was not a whole lot else for them to do other than go work at the factory or get some sort of mundane job. And there was nothing that they really wanted to do. Like, they were sort of built for rock and roll and that was about it. And I think that's been one of the motivating factors is, behind Drive By Truckers, and something that nearly everybody in the band said something to the effect of, "We're just not good for anything else." And I think that's also something that they saw in Skynyrd, because I you know, that there's just not a whole lot that Ronnie Van Zant is going to be good at beyond being, you know, a rock star, or a rock and roll frontman, you know.
Yeah, I could see Patterson teaching English at like some small liberal arts college in Tennessee. But other than that, I think you're right.
So I can see that too. I'd take that class.
Yeah, absolutely. Read the Confederacy of Dunces or something like that.
Yeah, Barry Hanna and Vic Chestnut on the same curriculum is what I want to see.
Sounds good. So after Southern Rock Opera was released, they bring on Jason Isbell to the band, and he's another guy from North Alabama. It's a weird decision to, as a band that has two great singer-songwriters and guitarists, to bring on another singer-songwriter guitarist. Why did they hire Jason Isbell?
I think they're just hoarders. I think they're just hoarding all the great songwriters. I
mean, it's sort of like if you hear Jason Isbell and he doesn't have a band, and you could hire him, why not? But it's also like, in a way, it's a sort of like selfish but also selfless gesture to be like, we're going to bring on this kid who might overshadow us in 5 years.
Yeah, and didn't seem all that unhappy when he did. I mean, they're all great friends, and I've never detected any bitterness that they might have about his success at all. Like, you know, I think they're happy that he kind of graduated from the truckers and went on to greater things. Like, but I think as with a lot of things, it just kind of happened by happenstance. Like, they had a guitar player named Rob Malone, and he sings and plays guitar on Southern rock opera. And they self-released this album and was starting to pick up some steam, and they got Spin Magazine to come down to the Shoals to do a story on them. And so they set up to play the entire album acoustically for the writer. And Rob Malone just doesn't show up. Meanwhile, like, they're kind of just like embarrassed by this. Like, this is very unprofessional. They were very unhappy. And it just doesn't sound good. They need that other guitar player. And Patterson spots Jason Isbell, who he had known. They had played a couple of shows, like solo acoustic shows together. And Jason knew all this material. And so he was like, hey, why don't you just come up and play in the band? And he just didn't leave for 5 years. I think one of the things that I found really charming about talking to Jason for the book was just how much he learned just by being in this band, not only about the South and how you can write about it as a subject, but about music. And he'd never heard Pylon or PJ Harvey or the Pixies. He'd never been on an airplane. He'd never been to New York City. He'd barely been out of the state. He went up to Memphis for college, and that was about as far as he'd gone. So, like, I think they kind of showed the world to him. And, you know, they'd been working at this for 15 years, and he just kind of came into this band that had this audience. And I think that kind of freaked him out a little bit, too, because he started doing some things that were inadvisable with regards to alcohol and drugs, and ended up getting kicked out. But again, like, I think that the lessons he took from being in the Drive-By Truckers are paying off to this day, mm-hmm. in pretty much everything he does. So, I think it was a win-win for everybody involved in the long run.
Yeah. I wonder too. I mean, I think his best album is Southeastern, which is the album he recorded after he got sober. And I wonder if that was maybe one of the steps on his, you know, road to rock bottom, that, you know, getting kicked out of the band in some ways, I don't know, maybe spurred him to look at some of the choices he'd been making. I don't know him, and I'm not a psychologist or anything, but I wonder if maybe there was a deeper significance in that as well.
I totally agree. I think that's his best album, and I think it's very significant that his best album came when he got sober. I think he did have to own up to a lot of bad decisions, bad behavior, you know, a marriage that went bad while he was in the band. He was married
to Sean Tucker, somebody who was in the band.
Yeah. there's a whole lot to own up to that. And I think, you know, he seems to be still owning up to that in the way that I think all, you know, people suffering addictions have to continually own up, because it's not a recovery is not a thing that has a destination. It's mm-hmm. just, you're always sort of on it, and you're always living with that. And I think that's something that he has foregrounded in his music. There's a song on Reunions, which is maybe my second favorite of his albums. That's it gets easier, but it never gets easy. And mm-hmm. I think that he's found a way to really speak to that in song in a meaningful way.
Yeah. I mean, he's maybe one of the most, like, popularly successful, you know, broadly speaking, rock and roll singer-songwriters of the past 20 years at this point. I mean, he had a song in A Star Is Born. Like, it doesn't get much bigger than that.
And he's in the next Scorsese movie too. So, you know,
yeah,
he's doing pretty well. His level of success is really remarkable, especially considering that he's not part of like the Nashville mainstream, he's not getting radio play like Luke Bryan, yet he is, he's huge. He, you know, he's definitely one of the best Twitter users.
Yes.
In rock and roll. His Twitter account is incredible.
But yeah, I looked into getting tickets for his upcoming show in Brooklyn. It was like $80 or $85 or something like that. I mean, he's, you know, he's big time.
Wow.
I mean, it's really just incredible to me, like how much he absorbed from them so fast too. Like, I didn't realize until I read your book that the song Outfit was based on the actual advice his dad gave him when he joined the band. And it's already like such a, not only such a great song, but such a great Drive-By Trucker song. It just feels like totally of a piece with everything that they'd recorded before that.
Yeah, and it's so rich with detail. I mean, he even tells the make of the car he was conceived in, mm-hmm. and the town that he's not supposed to steal paint from. Like it's just that level of detail, I think, was something that he picked up from the band. But also, again, like one of those songs where, you know, you're going to sing that every night. You're going to have to live up to that song. And, you know, I don't know that that necessarily worked while he was in the Truckers, but I think mm-hmm. it seems to be working now. And, but yeah, that song is, yeah, I even now when he plays it, like for people who've never heard the Truckers version, who are fans only of his solo material, it's still a favorite.
Yeah. There's a great moment in the live acoustic album that he did with Cooley and Patterson where someone screams out for Outfit and he goes, "I love that song. I was playing that song all day. I was humming it on the way to the theater, but I never play that song right after someone requests it." So you can hear yourself say that or you can hear me play it, but you can't do both. Which is just a great way to kind of put him in his place, but also to, you know, genuinely acknowledge, "I do appreciate that you like this song I wrote, but I got other stuff." I'd love to talk about another Isbell song that you write about in the book, which is TVA, which is I feel like a kind of lackluster song in its DBT version, but there's a live album on, I forget which Jason Isbell live album, but where it really comes alive and becomes a song that, at least for me and my sort of like nostalgia for the New Deal, is sort of unspeakably moving when it talks about the guys from the Works Progress Administration coming to this field in North Alabama and giving his grandfather a job. What do you feel like? I mean, that's another side of the Southern thing that, you know, the South is and has been for a long time one of the regions that disproportionately receives federal aid, you know, relative to what it brings in taxes, and large parts of the Southern economy are completely dependent on these big government projects, not, you know, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Administration in particular, but, you know, electricity co-ops and, you know, damming projects and agricultural subsidies. I mean, that seems to be a you know, one kind of example of Isbell kind of trying to say, you can ground a kind of progressive redistributive politics in the history of this place that I'm from. Do you feel like that's kind of what he's expressing in that song?
That's an interesting aspect. And I never thought of it in terms of the South getting a disproportionate amount of federal funding for that. Although I'm not calling into question what you're saying. It never struck me that way.
Even if you don't phrase it that way, but in just sort of like, hey, there was a big government project and it gave electricity to most of the South. And so when Ronald Reagan comes around and says the government's the problem, not the solution, you know, us Southern boys should stick up on the back of our neck, right?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, it's that story is very illustrative of that point of the impact, the positive impact that the government can have, because you look at it like the government created that dam and they created the TVA and brought power and industry to this area and jobs. But then you had like Ford, who's like, yeah, I want to rent that dam for 100 years for like, you know, some some beads and like a couple of quarters I have in my pocket. Like that kind of, like it was insultingly low. Even for that time period, it was insultingly low. And it's like, I can't imagine what would have happened if he had been allowed to do that. But he was just like, somebody was like, I want, like, you know, this thing that has benefited this community, I want to have it. And that seems at odds with the kind of, you know, ethos that created the whole thing. So, and he was of course defeated, but I always think it's such an interesting sort of alternate history. If he had been able to rent that dam and bring this manufacturing industry to the state, what would the South in general have looked like then if people weren't migrating to northern cities for those same jobs? So yeah, I mean, there's so much. I mean, one of my favorite chapters to write in the book was that chapter about Jason Song TVA and Cooley Song Uncle Frank, which is about a man who's displaced by the building of the dam, tragically displaced. And just researching that dam, just that one dam, and what it meant for the South, culturally, industrially, commercially, culturally, everything. It was, I don't know, it was really fascinating. I feel like that section of that chapter could have been an entire book.
Let's, as we're kind of winding down, I'd like to kind of come back to where we started, which is the album American Band. A pivotal album for them, a kind of late career peak, but one that had some, you know, quote unquote fans, or, you know, I give them a credit, maybe some of them were genuine fans, kind of saying, oh, you know, they've sold out, they've gone liberal or something like that. That seems like a sort of mystifying reaction to me, you know, as someone who's paid attention to their earlier albums. What about that album do you think kind of turned off some of their earlier fans?
I think it was just this idea that, okay, they started writing about many of the things that they had been writing about all along. They were just doing it without the filter of character and setting and story. And so they were addressing things really, really directly in a way that they really hadn't. And so you have a song like Raymond Cassiano about gun control. You have a song about like what it means about, you know, violence against blacks in America. They've been writing about violence. They've been writing about gun control. They've been writing about the urban-rural divide, income inequality, all these things that they were talking about on this album. But it had always been through these characters and these places. And so I think when you strip that away and you realize you show people what's at the core, I think people weren't expecting that. I don't think people thought they had been duped or anything, but they just didn't realize that the forces affecting the characters in their favorite trucker songs were these same things that they were singing about on American Band. And I think that's, it's a, like I said earlier in our conversation about how that was so perfectly done that you thought that they had been planning it the entire time. And I think that's true. It's sort of like pulling back the curtain to say, you know, what's backstage or something. It's a really powerful moment, I think, because it perfectly aligns with these national conversations we're having about so many things at that time. And, you know, when you do that, and I think in an environment that is as politically polarized, you will have a lot of people just, you know, rejecting it all. And they even talked about having shows where people would come out and make a big show of leaving, like leaving in mass, like about 20, 40 people just being like, yeah, we're walking out. And it's like, well, you bought the ticket, you know, like that's right. not a really good protest. But I think it really brought the people who did stay behind closer together. And it did sort of create this idea that, well, not create this idea, but it definitely reflected this idea that you can be Southern and you can be rural. You can even call yourself a redneck and you can still be politically progressive. Mm-hmm. You can still approach the world with compassion and empathy and curiosity rather than shut everybody out who's not like you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why a lot of the fans really responded to that album, because I think it gave them something that you know, showed a sort of a way to dissent against this idea of the South as this giant block of red states, mm-hmm. that you can sort of be yourself and there's room for you and you're just as Southern as the sort of stereotypical redneck Southerner, mm-hmm. that progressivism is its own kind of being Southern. And I don't know, I think for me at least that was very important, especially at a time when all of America looked like it was out of whack politically and culturally, you know, and so much so that I even wondered, like, should I even write this book? Should I even be writing about the South? That's why I wanted to write about Confederate monuments in Richmond. That's why I wanted to write about these, you know, urban development in Athens and all these things, because, you know, these are things that I thought would be little diversions that I would take. I did not know they would take up the real estate in the book that they do. And it was mainly just through listening to the music, listening to these songs, diving in and seeing where they sent me, seeing like which directions mm-hmm. they pointed in. And I think that, you know, it became a political book because that's where the band ended up, but that's what they had always been all along. And I think that is something I kind of realized along the way. It was like they'd always been having these conversations. It's just suddenly these conversations became more amplified on the national level.
Yeah. The reaction to that sort of cohort among the fans kind of reminds me of the meme of the guy in the cowboy hat. And it says, there are only two things I love in this world, outlaw country and the law.
I haven't seen that meme, but yeah,
it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, I understand it's a complicated thing, but like, you know, I don't think there's a single Drive-By Truckers character that would like be happy to see the cops show up, you know.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it.
Well, Stephen, I really enjoyed talking to you about this book. And I want to say to our listeners, too, despite the kind of very specific and kind of quoting chapter and verse nature of my questions, this is not just a book for super hardcore DBT fans. I think this would be a great introduction to somebody who hasn't heard the band before and is maybe interested in some of these themes. I think reading this book will give you a kind of greater appreciation for what they're up to. And, you know, if the kind of like crunchy Southern rock isn't your jam, maybe reading this book as you kind of dive in would be a good way to kind of understand where they're coming from a little bit more. So I'd really encourage anybody who's interested to check out this book. It certainly taught me a lot. And I really thank you for coming on the show to talk about it, Stephen.
Oh man, it's my pleasure. And I've had a blast. Thank you so much.